Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyappa and I have with me Nirav Kanodra to run you through the news and events of the week that was. We're unfortunately missing our friend Abhishek Paul today. He can't join us. But it's been a week of slim pickings. There's not much to talk about, but there were a few headlines, of course. OpenAI's CEO Sam Altman is making a trip to India and there were a few interesting conversations and comments on that. Then the Enforcement Directorate has issued a show cause notice to Xiaomi under the FEMA Act violation. We also had this bit of a controversy, as is expected right now, with some of the Khalistani elements in Canada. And there were a few updates on the India and Nepal relations as well. Both the prime ministers met and some interesting progress coming out of that. All of this and more on this Bharat Varta Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us. If this is your first time, we publish episodes on politics, policy and culture. Do follow or subscribe to us on your favorite platform to stay updated. All right, let's get to the first piece of news. Sam Altman, the founder and CEO of OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, visited India earlier this week. When asked about a foundational AI model being built in India, he said, "It's totally hopeless to compete with us on training a foundational model. You shouldn't even try, and it's your job to, try anyway." This statement has since been the talk of the town, highlighting the shortcomings of the country's talent base and how much room there is to grow. Sam also met the Prime Minister Narendra Modi and also lauded India's effort in building our digital public infrastructure. Well, a lot of people took offense on this remark, but it is pretty much standard remark for any tech CEO being asked at a conference, right? I suppose maybe the occasion did not merit that, right? So this was almost like a Bharat Darshan kind of a thing. And there were a lot of non-tech and non-CEO, non-business types as well there. So it could have been taken out of context. But yeah, why would anyone want to encourage competition, right? But I did feel though that I hope it pisses off people, I hope it irks some people into doing something about it, because obviously we have lagged behind on deep tech. India, for all of the tech talent that we have, really has not done much on the hard technology, right? And you could argue that, in a country that is at our per capita income, we're still a poor nation, there are a lot more obvious ways of creating value through tech, right? Whether it is through arbitrage or, even building stuff and so on and so forth. But when there is a market opportunity, Indian entrepreneurs are very quick to grasp it. Look at something like SaaS, for example, right? Software as a service. I've speak about this plenty on my other podcast, The Startup Operator. SaaS has been a 30-year thing in the making right now. And, you have companies in Bangalore, Chennai, Coimbatore, Surat, Pune, elsewhere, right? Really eating market share from some of the largest SaaS companies in the US, whether it's Salesforce, Workday, SAP, Oracle, whoever you call it, right? Whoever you name it. And so I think, given that the market opportunity for AI will open up, I am actually positive that, Indian entrepreneurs will work on such things, right? Look, I mean, obviously building a foundational model takes a lot of effort. It's a non-trivial thing. OpenAI itself has been like a 6 or 7 year experiment in the making, right? So I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I'm saying it's a problem worth solving. And people often say that, OpenAI has all of these resources. They have the smartest people in the valley. How can we even compete? To that, you look at OpenAI itself, right? I mean, they're also an outlier. Right. Google had, hundreds, if not thousands of the smartest AI researchers. Right. Apple has some of the smartest folks. Meta has some of the smartest folks. And then OpenAI is, at least it was started as a nonprofit, right, with about $100 million of funding, which is nothing compared to the resources that some of these larger people have in tech. So I think it's not about that. I think, technology often has demonstrated to us it takes about 10 smart people or maybe even lesser in a room to come up with something truly revolutionary. I think take it in our stride and, let success prove people wrong, I suppose, right? Nirav, any comments?
Yeah, so I think a couple of areas where I feel like India has some sort of efficiency. So one is, yes, for all these AI models, I think there's been a lot of talk about the resources that go into it, including advanced chips, including, so you need capital, you need technology or hardware, and you need people. So India does have a lot of people, maybe not everyone, people in India are not at the cutting edge, but a lot of Indians who are working in all these AI firms or in large FANGs, etc., are quite advanced. So, and India can actually scale up very fast. So in labor, India has an advantage. Second thing is, AI, OpenAI, everything is right now just in English. But India has many languages, right? and there's a lot of data over there. So second is in regional language AI, I think India can have like training data sets. Lastly, what I would say is India has a lot of data, more population transacting digitally. You can have a larger data set, right? So I think India does have an advantage over there as well. Now, does India create a new ChatGPT or does India create something totally new which we don't know about, right? Yeah. So I think there are places where India has a bit of strength. Between capital and labor, yes, India has a lot more labor. And maybe we get a lot of smart people instead of working on tech to ensure last minute grocery delivery. Maybe some people will start moving to doing these things as well, right? So I think, see, it's a large enough country. Sam Altman can say that, okay, there's no point trying, but you should try. But that's what it is.
Yeah.
See, people in Google didn't really say it in these words, but they thought that, oh, there's no point trying competing with us on search. And yes, it's like been like 25 years of Google search, and there isn't a better search engine, but ChatGPT gives you something better, right? So I feel that there is opportunity. That's all, right? You may not create another ChatGPT, or you may not create like exact clone, but you create something else. Like, for example, like how maybe like Chinese company TikTok revolutionized social media in a different way, right? It did not create a copy of Twitter or a copy of Facebook, but created something else. So I think, yes, there is opportunity. And I think, there is good reason. To be fair, a lot of people don't appreciate this as much. But for all global tech companies, India is their second biggest labor market outside the US. And that is one of the reasons why OpenAI CEO has come to India. Yeah, he's meeting exactly. Prime Minister. There could be an opportunity to create another campus for OpenAI in India. There could be opportunity of gathering India data. Let it be through our digital payments network. Let it be through our railway payments. Or like, there's a lot of data being generated. And we're not, the thing is, where is it stored? How are we dealing with it, etc.? And if we use AI to get out signals from this data, there could be a lot more optimization done, right? So maybe hypothetically it could be railway routes. India is so much under capacity in a lot of things that wherever you add capacity is okay. But how do we optimize once you get a little bit ahead, right? So again, I think there's a lot of opportunity, not to be disheartened. In fact, hopefully enrages thousands or hundreds of entrepreneurs and they build something else. So, yeah.
No, absolutely. And see, one thing I want to add is that we're still early in the game, right? Because ChatGPT itself is obviously getting a lot of competition from other GPT models and so on, right? I mean, people are coming up with cheaper variants of that. It's by no means you can call the race at this point of time, right? There's still a lot of way ahead. I mean, of course, obviously they've taken a head start, but it's not late by any measure, right? So, all right, let's move on to some geopolitical stuff. Last week, a tableau in a parade in Canada depicted India's former Prime Minister Indira Gandhi's assassination. The Minister for External Affairs, Dr. S. Jaishankar, condemned this, saying there is a larger underlying issue about the space being given to separatists in Canada and that this is a problem for India and a problem for Canada as well. The Canadian government has not just been indifferent towards these incidents, but has also taken a stance against India with the National Security Advisor, alleging that India is interfering in Canada's internal matters. Well, what can we say about this, Nirav? It is kind of troubling that, you know, these kind of incidents have just ramped up over the months and years, right?
So one thing is, A, it is in very bad taste. Enacting any assassination, I don't know about Canadian precedents, but it would be very much in bad taste for, say, India to enact an assassination of JFK or Lincoln, or like recreate something about the Civil War, right? Each country has their own issues. And frankly, these separatist Khalistani sympathizers, they may feel maybe to a small micro segment that they're acting with bravado. But if anything, this would actually make somebody think twice against, like for a neutral observer, think twice against that are these sensible people asking for a sensible thing, right? And if they have like a real grievance, if they feel that, oh, they need a separate nation for whatever reasons, they can do it in a better format. They all come from India. India has shown the world what a peaceful and non-violent demonstration can do and raise awareness for whatever their goal is. Maybe I agree, maybe I disagree, maybe I don't have a complete picture. But this is very, very bad taste. And this is doing themselves no favors, doesn't do their goals any. And maybe Canada feels just taking cheap pot shots. Doesn't matter which party is in power or doesn't matter which party you support. This would call you like kind of co-conspirator in a crime. And it's you should rather be ashamed of it. So anyways, this is completely bad taste. I think Indians aren't doing anything about Canada. We are not interfering in their internal things. This Canadians also should like, I don't know, there should be social shame about this. Or there should be either some sort of like a penalty or to the people who are involved in it. And maybe, yes, it's done inside Canada. They can do what they want. Second thing is Canada could have like a bigger role with India via an FTA. We are complementary countries. Canada is a large open area with like small population. Very large Indian diaspora now is a bigger, like a growing percentage. They could do a lot more with India. India is like a heavily populated country with a lot of labor resources. So India could do like a lot of manufacturing exports to Canada, etc. Right. So there could be a lot of things where you could work together. And this cuts across political divide. Should think of it that way. So Canada and India have a lot to offer each other. If they work closely together, Canada is a large country with a small population and a rich country. India is a poor country with a large population, can provide a lot of cheaper goods and services. Canada is a large Indian diaspora, united with the same language. Some sort of shared history, part of the erstwhile Commonwealth. So I think we need to think, and this should cut across political lines across both countries, that if they work together, you have a lot more to gain from each other, right? Via trade, etc. And all these things just leave a bad taste in everyone's mouth and actually kind of makes the people want to dissociate from each other. So, yeah, but it is for the Canadian authorities to deal with it. And they should ask themselves a question that if they had done a similar tableau about the US, how would have Americans reacted? And they should think about it the same way.
Yeah, and you don't have to know too much about history and politics or Khalistan movement or whatever to understand that, you know, depicting an assassination is in poor taste, right? I mean, well, hopefully, I mean, you know, they do something about it. All right, moving on. The Enforcement Directorate announced on Friday that it sent show cause notices to Xiaomi India for supposed infractions of the foreign exchange law, totaling to more than 5,551 crores. Wow. In September last year, ED had seized the company's bank accounts and launched an investigation under FEMA. The company had violated the FEMA norms and transferred the amount under the guise of royalty payments. Once the case is settled, the accused may be required to pay a penalty that may be three times the amount violated. Wow. So I think, for those of us who've been following this, it's been quite on the cards. You know, I mean, there have been all these tax raids starting last year itself. So for those of us who've followed the news on this, it's not really a surprise. There have been tax raids, starting last year itself. And you know, last two or three years has not been great for Xiaomi. Obviously, you know, being a Chinese company, there is a whole anti-China sentiment in India. Their market share has dropped as well. I think 2019 or 2020, early 2020, it was around 26-27%. And I would hazard a guess and say it's probably half of that right now, right? About 15-16% at least. Also, during this time, Manu Kumar Jain, who was the MD and CEO of India, has quit the business, right? And he was instrumental in building Xiaomi in India. I mean, Manu was former CEO of Jabong, met the Xiaomi CEO, I think 2014 and 2015, and started up their India operations here. And Xiaomi pioneered a bunch of interesting things, right? Like selling, exclusively online. They had this tie-up with Flipkart and so on and so forth. And yeah, I mean, the initial phones were cheap, loaded with a bunch of features and so on, right? But I think the crux of the issue is that they've transferred these funds to a couple of US entities. There's sort of a tax evasion angle to this. And I think the CEO and the CFO both have been booked, right? And they will have to face the consequences of this, I suppose. Nirav, do you think that, you know, this is like a broader point as well to sort of signal to Chinese companies? I mean, you know, we earlier banned TikTok. Now we're going after Xiaomi. Some sort of a soft signaling as well? Maybe not so soft.
See, two things are there. One is, once your popularity falls, right, and your sales fall in India, then you kind of start thinking, how do I save costs? How do I like try and do things? And like, so you're trying and skirting on the gray areas. That this happens in a lot of companies everywhere, that they start trying to evade taxes and do certain things to juice up the bottom line when they are in trouble. And maybe it's just that they're trying to evade taxes and EDS thing. It's nothing to do with the nationality or whatever it is, right? So that could be one thing. Second thing is that I think even Huawei was banned from certain auctions or spectrum. And some of this is like probably security or like malware, which could be there in phones. So I think those are separate security concerns, security issues which India has. But basically, I think for this is true for any company, whether it's an Indian company, a multinational company, or any other, it could be Chinese, Korean, Taiwanese, Japanese company operating. You operate within the laws of the land. And if you have like taxes due, or if you have, India has capital controls. So, and you're fully aware of it, right? It's not that, oh, the US, you can move money in and out easily, right? It's not a country with a open capital account. So once whatever investment you make, there is certain procedure of like taking money out of the country, and you got to follow it, pay the valid taxes. And I think just leave it at that. I think if you're trying to cut corners or do certain things, then you would have to pay a penalty. And this is true for anyone. And I would hazard a guess that when a company is struggling, or like its results are not as good as the previous year, and then you're trying to do everything to grow year on year, these are the times where people cross the boundary lines at times, and maybe it is just that. So,
and finally, we have some more geopolitics. A few days ago, Nepal Prime Minister Pushpa Kamal Dahal visited India for talks with the Prime Minister Modi. During the visit, the two countries signed a 10-year energy trade deal. However, India will not be buying any electricity produced with Chinese help. India also will not be providing an air route to allow airports to be built with assistance to operate. Nirav, you know, what can you tell us about this whole developing India-Nepal relationship?
See, I think one is you have to sympathize with Nepal. Nepal is one small landlocked country between two large countries, the world's two largest population countries. And so it has to kind of have good relations with both. I think Nepal had a lot of investment as part of the Belt and Road Initiative from China. They got a lot of overcapacity, right? And the amount of power that they generate, they don't have the industries to consume it. Nor can the power at that price is like easy for people in Nepal with their level of income to buy consumer electronics or use that much power. So they have to sell it to someone. Again, India said that they will not be buying power from the power plants which are built with help of Chinese. But earlier, they have some older power plants. So what Nepal can do is substitute all their domestic consumption can be from the Chinese power plants. But their additional power which is generated is sold to India. And see, that is fine. In a way, India is a country which is a huge shortage of power. We've grown in leaps and bounds. But this is a good thing that if India can buy power, also makes Nepal a little more aligned. They have difficulty as like dealing with monopolies or monopsony. A single buyer, right? So that one thing is there as well. So they border like five Indian states, I think, Uttarakhand, Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, Bengal, and Sikkim. And so if these places, there's a little additional power generation, a little power sent, this can be a positive for India. It's good from energy security perspective as well. For all those people who are like more green, a lot of it is hydroelectric power as well through the river. So that is good. Similar, I think the airports, what Nepal has, a lot of them are like bordering India, like in the valley. And they were targeting like Indian customers either to visit Nepal or like Indians who live near the border states to cross into Nepal via road and then fly out. So I think this also probably kind of reduces, if they don't have access to Indian airspace, it reduces the return on the project, right? If you have to go fly in a roundabout way via China into Nepal. And for Nepal, even though it shares a border with China on the Tibetan plateau in China, the population is very little. Whereas in the Gangetic plain in India, it is very dense and like huge population. And like even Nepal is part of the Gangetic plain, Indo-Gangetic plain, where a few rivers like Kosi, etc. come from Nepal. So those things are there. Nepal has to balance its thing as well. I think there are some talks about like more road connectivity, a little bit rail connectivity as well. So that is there. For India also, another security thing is if like Chinese railways go all the way up to Nepal and then from Nepal they have like direct connectivity back to India, this could create like kind of a easy path for the Chinese army to invade in case of a conflict or whatever as well. So again, it's a balancing act. India has to look after its own interest. Nepal has to look after its own interest. You've got to be a little bit sympathetic to Nepal as well. They're sandwiched between two giants. And we have to see, in a way, what works best for India. And probably China is doing what works, trying to work what's best for them. They have their whole ring of pearl strategy about like having assets all across the world. And a lot of the Belt and Road strategy is also getting geopolitical leverage over these countries, that once I give you something, then you kind of have to align with me in a lot of other things. Let's see. But I think, see, this is a sensible thing. At least having a long-term electricity purchase agreement with Nepal benefits us as well, because Nepal can generate a lot of electricity but has no customers. India has a lot of customers. So that's a win-win in a way. And we have to see that how do we get Nepal to lean a little more towards India versus a little bit towards China, where it has been. India, frankly, in an unfortunate way, had been, let's say, asleep at the wheel for a long time, where every country neighboring India had better relationship with China. Was it Sri Lanka, Maldives, Nepal, Pakistan, obviously, but Pakistan, there is a little less hope because of earlier rivalry between India and Burma, Myanmar, right? All of these countries have bad, better relationship with China than with India. And India should try and win them back. That's the thing. Maybe this is one small step towards it, but it is a step.
Also, it could be the opportune time for us to step in as well, right? I mean, I think people are recognizing the downsides of the Belt and Road Initiative at this point, whether it's the Sri Lankans or, you know, even Maldives and Nepal and so on, right? I mean, lesser said about Pakistan, the better. But I think everyone is kind of realizing the downside of the supposed, generosity with the Chinese loans and the infrastructure and whatnot, right? I mean, I think on that front, the game is sort of up. It's there for everyone to see.
Yes. So, again, maybe India played its card better. I don't know. But this is a nice time that, yes, as you said, and we have to try and work to win them back and win them back in a deal which is not, see, we don't even want to have diplomacy or something which is very one-sided as well. Like, that's what I wanted to emphasize, that Nepal also has a particular situation. You have to sympathize with them as well. And you have to see what can work best for both together without having too much leverage. Because then that is very lopsided agreements. Those kind of create resentments and they're not sustainable.
All right. That brings us to a rather short Bharatvartha Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you have suggestions for guests and topics that we should cover, do let us know. We're always listening on our social platforms. Nirav, are you going to be watching the match today and tomorrow?
Yeah, I will be watching. Now it's going to be interesting. I kind of disagree with our selection, or like after winning the toss, choosing to field. But I'm like an armchair commentator. So the people over there, the team management probably knows better. But see, India did give up the game quite a bit, but it's not been a walkover. We are kind of fighting back. Cricket over 5 days, it's a long game. So that is why there are more chances, more miracles which can happen. So hopefully India does fight back and it's not like a one-sided game. I think it's still like 85 or 90% Australia wins. Maybe there is rain, there could be a draw. And or maybe India really does manage to bowl well, get them all out, or like bat really well for a long period of time, and if not win, at least escape with a draw. So yeah, but it's an interesting match.
Yeah, I mean, as we speak, Australia is leading by about 296 runs at the loss of 4 wickets. So let's see, chasing maybe, 400 plus, batting second is always difficult. Let's see what we can make of it. So thank you again for joining us. From Nero and myself, do stay safe, take care, and we'll see you next week. Jai Hind.